This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Health and Living. I'm Lee Chui Lin. McDonald's says it is phasing out human antibiotics in chickens in its United States restaurants, joining other fast food chains Chipotle and Chick-fil-A. The use of antibiotics has come under the spotlight as the World Health Organization warns that even common infections could kill as more viruses become resistant to antibiotics. So what steps should governments and civil society take to combat the use of antibiotics in animal feed, and what are the possible alternatives? Latifa Hassan is the head of the Veterinary Laboratory Diagnostics at University Putra Malaysia, and she is joining me in the studio right now to tell us more. Antibiotics have been used globally to fight viruses, promote growth in animals for around 50 years. Can you tell us how this came to be?
First of all, antibiotics don't really do anything to viruses. They are used to fight against bacterial infection, not viruses. Can you repeat the question just now?
Sure. They've been used to fight bacteria. They promote growth in animals. But can you tell us how all this came to be from 50 years ago and all this being used in the in the agriculture or in the meat industry?
Okay, as you know, Alexander Fleming first discovered antibiotics in late 20s by accident. Nonetheless, and after that, it was very well used and prescribed in human to treat a lot of human infection, and also in among the animals for veterinary medicine use. It is widely prescribed. I think in the 1940s or was it 1950s, the farmers started realizing that after World War II, they need to hasten up the production of animals, and then making the animals bigger over a short period of time. So they were looking for ways to do that, and research were done in that pursuit. And then by accident again, it was discovered that if they were to feed animals, at that time they were trying to do experiment on B12 and see the effect of B12 on animal growth. And by accident, the B12 were mixed in a barrel by which was used to produce antibiotics. So the experiment later found out that the group that were treated with the B12 with contaminated that has been contaminated with antibiotics actually grew so much faster compared to the other groups. So that was how it was discovered antibiotics actually can somehow enhance the growth of food animals.
So antibiotics then, was it very effective in terms of killing diseases in animals?
It is. It is, and it is one of the major tools by which vets use to alleviate pain and suffering from animals. So to use that in therapy, it's really you can't take away that, because then you'll be taking away the tool by which vets use in order to treat the animals.
We see a lot of bacteria. I say a lot, but I suppose it's a more recent thing. We've come to terms with the fact that there seem to be some diseases that pass relatively easily from animals to humans, and so we've kind of gotten used to the idea that we not necessarily share some diseases, but certainly there is that spread. What's the difference between human antibiotics that are used in human therapy and antibiotics that are used in veterinary therapy?
First of all, there are diseases that are shared between animals and humans, and these are called zoonotic diseases. And some of the antibiotics that are used in animals are similar or the same category as the one that are used in human medicine, but some are completely different. And some of the antibiotics that are being used for growth promoting in livestock, some of them are not being used for the purpose of therapy in human. The proportion, I think, by which the antibiotics in human are also being used at for therapy or for growth promoting in animals, I would say it's about 60%.
Okay, so when we look at that time period that you were discussing earlier, that early post-war period when people were trying to find ways to make sure that the money that they were investing in animals wasn't going to waste, were antibiotics cheap and easy to administer at that point, and are they still the same today?
Some antibiotics are quite cheap, but some are quite expensive. It depends on what is the prescription for. Like chlorpromazine, it has been known to be used in many countries less developing countries in the animal industry. That's because it's quite cheap. And according to the people who actually make it, it's quite easy to manufacture. But some are expensive. It depends on what is the purpose and what is the objective of that antibiotics.
And in terms of administering it to the animals, is that quite an easy process?
Well, it depends also. There's many ways by which you administer the antibiotics. In livestock, you can use the route of giving them in water or in feed as a supplement in feed. But for therapy, usually you give them oral doses or you give them intravenously, depending on what is the purpose of that administration.
When we think of livestock, I think here, we think about chickens, we think about other forms of meat, but are antibiotics used in fish and prawn farms? And if so, are we also seeing the same strain of resistance in seafood?
They are, unfortunately, they are being used also in aquaculture, shrimp and fish. And definitely, whenever you use antibiotics, the environment will provide a selective pressure for bacteria to be resistant to it. So you probably will see the similar trend of resistance that you probably have seen in livestock, to the one that you see in the aquaculture.
How long does that resistance take to show up? Because you hope that when you give antibiotics, I mean, the point is that it defeats bacteria, but if they're going to just start kind of forming their own revolutions, how long does that usually take, that resistance?
Depends on the type of antibiotics. It could be a few months or a few years. And then also depends on like how the type of prescription that is being done. So there's a lot of factors that would influence how soon you see resistance in an organism. So it's very difficult to just say out, in terms of time period, very difficult.
But it's inevitable.
Yes, unfortunately it is, yeah.
Let's talk numbers. According to a new UK report commissioned by the government, antibiotic resistance will kill 300 million people by 2050, and that is a huge number. What are your fears for Malaysia? Do you see this as something that we might have to worry about?
Okay, first of all, I wasn't sure how did that number came about. So I assumed some kind of equation based on certain parameters. If that is we are seeing a lot more reports on cases of people not getting the treatment that they should because they have been infected by bacteria that are multi-resistant to various different antibiotics. And you are seeing more and more different species of bacteria that is developing these multi-resistant drugs. So that's a lot of fear, especially if you end up being the person who is infected with this microbe. But at the same time, I'm not sure in terms of the numbers whether that kind of numbers is it a tactic to scare people, or is that a real number?
Take us through the process of how antibiotic resistance is spread from animals to humans.
Okay. So human can get resistance genes. Human can get resistance bacteria, can be infected by resistant bacteria, not just from animals, but also from the human setting itself, from hospital, from the community. But if you are one specifically to talk about what's happening in the animal kind of setting, so human can get it directly from consuming animal products such as meat or milk that has been contaminated with the organisms that are multi-drug resistant or resistant to antibiotics. And then human can also get it indirectly from the environment, like for example, from a farm setting, animals, they defecate. Okay, and then their sewage will go to the river, for example, and to the soil. And then a human can get that if they were to consume contaminated water and also were to accidentally consume something that originates from the soil, and so So there's various ways by which human can get these microbes that are resistant.
When we look at these resistant strains of bacteria, how much harder is it to develop future antibiotics once you start to develop that resistance and it goes, you know, level by level?
If you look at the statistics, in the past decade, I think only about 10 new antibiotics had been approved for use in humans, as opposed to so many that had been approved in previous decades. So I think it's getting more and more challenging to find new drugs to replace antibiotics that organisms had developed resistance to. So I'm not sure. Right now, I think there's a lot of focus in terms of trying to find replacement for antibiotics, different ways by which disease could be cured without using antibiotics. So there's a lot of research that's focusing on that right now. So I'm not sure in terms of antibiotics for the future, what else is out there. But, you know, research and time will tell us.
It's quite worrying overall, though.
It is.
I'm speaking today with Latifa Hassan, who's the head of Veterinary Laboratory Diagnostics at University Putra Malaysia. We're discussing reevaluating antibiotics in livestock. Up next, we find out how Malaysia compares to a country such as the United States in terms of its usage of antibiotics in livestock, as well as what the alternatives are, you know, if we were to try to phase this out. You are listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. In the studio with me today, Latifa Hassan, head of the Veterinary Laboratory Diagnostics at University Putra Malaysia. We are discussing reevaluating antibiotics in livestock. So far, we've been discussing exactly how drug-resistant strains of bacteria can pop up, how effective antibiotics have been in terms of killing disease, as well as how we can get that, you know, passover from animals to humans. Now, the United States actually uses far more antibiotics in livestock than many other nations, according to Pew Research Center. And animals raised for food in America are given about 6 times as much antibiotics as animals in Norway and Denmark, just to compare. How does Malaysia look side by side with the United States?
It's very difficult to compare because our animal industry is not at the similar scale as what the industry in the US is.
Just as our population is not at a similar scale as well.
Yes, so it's kind of difficult to compare. But I think in the US, there's a lot of pressure among the big pharmaceutical company in terms of that produces all these drugs, promoting its usage. But in Malaysia, I don't think the pressure is to that extent. So it's kind of beneficial to us that it is not to that extent. And in the U.S., I was living there for a few years, so I know that antibiotics are being very well used in all animal livestock sectors, swine, cattle, pigs, poultry. In Malaysia, I am very aware that it is widely used in our poultry industry and in our swine industry. But in terms of our cattle industry, because we have a quite small cattle industry, and our cattle industry is mainly small scale, and the animals are raised rather extensively, the use of antibiotics is mainly for therapy. It's not really for growth promoting.
Perhaps this is a question that I should have asked you much earlier. Mm-hmm. Is it possible to have a livestock industry without the use of antibiotics? I mean, it's been in use for 5 decades now, at least. So is it a really necessary, compulsory part of our livestock industry in general? Can we not eat meat that hasn't been treated with antibiotics?
Okay, I think if you use antibiotics prudently, antibiotics should be used just to treat the animals. I mean, when animals are sick, you must treat them to alleviate the suffering. But in terms of using that therapeutically or off-label kind of usage, that I think can be reduced. And there are other options by which other different kind of practices by which you can do in order to make sure the animal are raised in an environment by which it is better for them and by which there's less disease around. So, but of course, to do that, it will be quite expensive. And the outcome will be that you probably have to pay a little bit more for your meat.
The Livestock Farm Practices Scheme sets standards for animal husbandry in Malaysia. How lax or stringent are its regulations on antibiotic use compared to the US and the EU?
It's difficult for me to comment about the regulation and how relaxed we are as compared to the US and to the EU. Because there's so many different variables by which determine how stringent we are. It's different industries, different, you know, it's different. Everything is different. But I know EU is very strict as compared to the US. Several EU countries have completely banned the use of antibiotics in their livestock, and several ban the use of antibiotics as growth promoting. I mean, they still allow it for therapy, but ban for the use of growth promoting. In the US, though, it's getting there. It's slow as compared to EU, but there's a lot of debate now. They're still debating about whether they should allow or completely ban the antibiotics. In Malaysia, some of the antibiotics are banned. The ones that are obviously causing harm to humans, those are completely banned, and it is stated so in the regulations and laws. In terms of relative comparison, I really can't comment on that.
What ministry in our country has oversight on the matter, though?
For human, Ministry of Health, and for animals, that would be under Department of Veterinary Services, that's under the Ministry of Agriculture.
What are the difficulties in terms of setting up surveillance systems in Malaysia of, you know, fully understanding, okay, so here we are overusing, here we are underusing, here we're using the right ones, you know, who determines that?
At the moment, I do not think we have a national monitoring system for antibiotic resistance. I know a lot of countries in the EU does, and I know US do. We are trying to develop one. I think we are heading that way, just from my conversation with my colleagues at the ministry. But it's a very complex thing that they have to set up, and I think they are progressing, but I'm not sure how fast they are, and I'm not sure at what stage the ministry is in terms of like trying to determine what is the suitable national surveillance system for antibiotic resistance of this country.
The Consumers Association of Penang says that around half of the 97 antibiotics fed to animals are not sanctioned by the World Health Organization. How did this come about?
You know, that's a good question. Until I saw the question that was posted, I wasn't even. I'm not really in tune to what the CAP state. I'm not sure where they got that numbers from. Around half of the 97 antibiotics fed to animals are not sanctioned, because the World Health Organization, they categorize the antibiotics into three. One is critical, and then highly important, and then important. If I look at the statistics correctly, and they were comparing it against the usage of antibiotics in US and in the EU, most countries actually used the antibiotics in the animal industry itself. Most of antibiotics used are among the one that is considered important, but not critical or highly important. I mean, there are some, but the proportion is quite small. So, again, I'm not sure. I'm not saying they're wrong. They probably are correct, but I'm not sure how they came to that number.
With consumers associations coming up with numbers like this, with people starting to, pay more attention in general, mm-hmm. As to what they're putting into their bodies, what they're consuming, Is global opinion slowly beginning to turn against the widespread use of antibiotics?
Definitely. Definitely. People are more aware. People are more demanding. And then people becoming more affluent and knowledgeable, they are demanding certain things, you know, better quality things, basically. So definitely, people are more aware and becoming more educated in terms of antibiotic resistance.
That's in terms of the consumers, the people who, you know, vote with their wallets. But what about Malaysian farmers? Is there awareness there? You know, is it going to be difficult to convince them that this is an issue and perhaps it needs some addressing?
I think they are beginning to be more aware and with education, of course. And then I think we are moving towards the right direction, basically. It'll take a little bit of time because usage of antibiotics is so well ingrained in the culture of animal industry that it's quite complex, and so it will take quite a bit of time and then patience in terms of trying to educate people and trying to let them know, you know, what is the right way and why you shouldn't do certain things.
Antibiotics have been used for a very, very long time. Now scientists are starting to come up with alternatives. What are the most promising ones, in your opinion?
There are so many, but right now, all the results that I'm seeing, they are viable. Sometimes in certain research, they found like it is beneficial or they get some positive kind of outcome. But in others, using the same methodology, they didn't find anything. So it's quite difficult to pinpoint exactly to which one is the best one right now.
If we look at something like interleukin 10, am I getting that right? Or IL-10, are you excited by this? How does this one work?
I was reading about this. The publication or the peer-reviewed publication of the discovery by Dr. Cook has not been published, so I'm not sure whether it's in the process or something. But the article that I read is all just based on different websites. So interleukin 10 is actually a cytokine. It's an immune modulator. So it acts as an anti-inflammatory kind of agent. So if I read this article correctly, so they fed a bunch of chicken with this interleukin 10, and then the chicken lay eggs, and then they process the eggs, and then they develop antibody against the interleukin 10. And then they fed it to the experimental animals to see if they can deter some kind of diseases. And apparently, from what I read, they did manage to get some kind of positive outcome by which quite a number of the animals were protected against the disease
with no side effects.
So my worry is this. Interleukin 10, since it acts as immunomodulator, you know, and when you feed the animals or even human later, you know, if you want to do it in human, then you're going to create a situation by which your body have no ability to balance out your own to shield themselves against its own defense mechanism. Like, you get inflammatory reaction all the time from various different things that's in the environment and just in your surroundings. So I think interleukin 10 helps in terms of balancing. When there's reaction in the body, it tones it down. But what's going to happen if you cannot tone it down? What's going to happen to your... You know, your body might end up eating its own cells, so that's the danger there. So I think it's very promising, but I think a lot more research has to be done and a lot of testing, and then they have to really figure out a lot of things before they say that this is the answer to antibiotics.
I think this is one of the main concerns that comes up anytime we talk about anything to do with immunotherapy.
Right.
You know, is that concern of not messing around, but I suppose changing a body's natural mechanism. So on the other hand, we have things like dietary alternatives like prebiotics and phytochemicals. What are your thoughts on those?
Yes. I think there's a lot of research also that is being performed on this prebiotics and also phytochemicals. Again, the results are variable depending on the type of experiments and, you know, what species they use and how much they use. So phytochemicals are they're promising because, you know, things like cloves and all the different herbs, if they manage to extract out the compound by which is has the ability to kill microbes, if they manage to find a way by which they can give it to animals and then the animals can do the same, then it'll be, you know, fantastic. And prebiotics is like, what is that? That's like a complex carbohydrate by which help the probiotics to be nourished in your body, and therefore the probiotics would compete with the disease causing agent and somehow deter or do away with diseases. So I've heard about this for many years. I think even till now research is still ongoing about this. There's no solid, how to say, product yet that can replace antibiotics.
What about the use of bacteriophages, viruses that infect certain bacteria?
Okay. Bacteriophages are viruses that can eat up bacteria. That kind of therapy has been used in Russia and Georgia, but not in other countries around the world. It certainly is not allowed to in most of the Western countries. According to what I read, it's actually quite effective in terms of killing the disease-causing bacteria. However, the difficulty is that it's very specific in terms of strain, and then also it could be... it could be very limiting because if you don't have the right strain of bacteriophage, it's not going to kill what the disease...
What you need it to
kill.
Yes,
what you need it to kill, basically.
Mm. How far away are we right now from these things becoming widely available as well as affordable? Because as you say, they are all right now just kind of either in research stages or being used here and there and not widely.
How far are we? I'm not sure how far we are from it being available, and I'm not sure how much it will cost, basically because none currently are available commercially. So I'm not sure how much they will cost, actually.
Is there much support in the pharmaceutical industry to support these, to support the research as alternatives to antibiotics? Or is there, you know, enough of... this is good enough within the industry because, of course, it stands to reason that they stand to profit.
The industry, they are really promoting a lot of research for alternative to antibiotics, and they are sponsoring or giving like grants to researchers to see whether, for example, certain prebiotics or probiotics are advantageous to be given to animals and what are the effects in terms of their growth rate, in terms of their feed efficiency. I know at least several pharmaceutical companies who are interested and has sponsored and given grants to do studies such as what I said just now.
If we look at just our conversation alone, we've ranged from our country to the US, to the EU, to Georgia. Mm-hmm. And all these countries have different needs. They'll have different types of livestock, different strains of bacteria. So is there no silver bullet? Can we not address this worldwide? Do we have to think about each country, you know, on its own strengths and deficiencies?
There is, unfortunately, no silver bullet. There is no no cure-all kind of elements out there. Every situation and every country is unique because they have their own ways of managing the animals, their own system. Their whole environment is different. And then the people are different. And then the whole ecosystem is different, basically. So unfortunately, I don't think there is a silver bullet out there.
If there's a growing appetite for better quality meat, you know, if that's something that we're heading towards, are we also going to have to get used to paying higher prices for these products?
We probably will have to get to paying a higher price. And that's unfortunate, actually, because it's so funny because it used to be that when we were in the older days, two or three decades ago, people would be raising animals in you know, behind the backyard in small numbers, and then no drugs given. But then it'll take forever to raise that animal to make sure that they have enough weight, enough meat on their body before it can be slaughtered. And then came in the intensive farming. You know, you 42 days and you can slaughter your chicken with 2 kilograms of meat. And now we are back to promoting free range and smaller scale farming. And then, you know, so it's very interesting in terms of the trend the trend of animal production over the decades. Yes, definitely we have to get used to the fact that it could be more pricey, the meat, and then also that the fact that poorer people might not be able to afford protein, basic protein, if everybody were to go to use the system by which produces very expensive meat.
Should we also be thinking about this issue more holistically? You know, earlier you alluded to the fact that perhaps farmers should consider taking away elements of how we raise our livestock that in turn lead to disease, right? Such as perhaps having smaller farms, better rearing conditions, better feeds and so on. Is that how we should be approaching it instead of just kind of looking at this one element of antibiotics and pinning all our hopes on that?
There is no easy answer to that question because there's a lot of, you have to think about the cost and the benefit situation. So smaller scale farm is very romantic. I mean, it's you see like people raising a few chickens and then the chickens are raised in free grazing and they're very happy. I mean, that's very ideal and very, how to say, it's quite romantic. But the population of the world is growing, really. And then not many people are interested to become agriculturists or farmers. A lot of people live in the urban setting or semi-urban setting. And I don't know. I don't know what is the good response to that.
It sounds
very nice. Yes, in the West and in the U.S. and in many European countries, free range and organic food is such a hype thing, and people are willing to pay a whole lot of money as compared to buying. When you compare the organic product as compared to the one that's raised conventionally, the price is markedly different, but people are willing to pay. But then we have to, I think, people who can afford it, they should go for this better product or the product that they know is more wholesome and antibiotic-free, antibiotic residues free, or all natural. But I think we should also think of you know, think of the other people who may not be able to afford protein at that price.
Finally, what message would you like to leave us with on antibiotics in livestock and whether or not that's going to change in the coming years, its widespread usage?
There's a lot of attempts to reduce the amount of antibiotics that are being used in livestock. And certainly, I would think that in the future, I'm not sure, like, I cannot give a timeline. In the future, less and less antibiotics would be used, just because I think the regulation would be stricter. However, if there's any room for improvement, I think we can do away with the growth promoting drugs, but we shouldn't take away totally the use of antibiotics in animals, livestock, or pets for that matter, just because if they are sick, if they are suffering, we need that to treat. And also, if we don't have that, human being will face problem because then we don't have food security. Our animals die because of diseases. We don't want that either. And it's important for food safety and food security reasons as well, these antibiotics. Maybe we can do away with the growth promoting, but not completely do away with the use of antibiotics in animals in general.
Thank you very much, Latifa. I've been speaking with Latifa Hassan, who's the head of veterinary laboratory diagnostics at University Putra Malaysia. We've been discussing re-evaluating antibiotics in livestock on Health and Living. You've been listening to The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.